I realized that no one was talking about men and masculinity. Men need to talk more. It doesn't need to be this stereotypical bullshit. The way that men express their depression often slips through the cracks. Anger, aggression, irritability, frustration. It's just pain and suffering that is misunderstood. Depression means that you feel. There are certain elements of anxiety that are superpowers. It's just when it tips over that it becomes problematic. Discomfort will pass, and every time we do it, it gets easier and easier.
Welcome to the Never Not Creative podcast. This episode does contain some warnings because of some explicit language and also some topics concerning mental health. If you do need help, please go and get help. Reach out to someone. There are some helplines listed on mentally-healthy.org. Just click on Need Help Now. So we're calling this mini-series Creativity and Football. It's a little bit Trojan horse, but because whenever we say the words mental health, we often end up reducing our audience by quite a bit when it comes to how many people will turn up or listen or read, because a lot of the men in the room don't join us. So this is for you. It's also for anyone else who wants to listen, because in particular for this episode, we've got one of the leading experts when it comes to mental health, and in particular when it comes to men's mental health, which is Dr. Zach Seidler. He's worked with us in the past on Asking for a Friend. He is often cited in some leading research when it comes to men's suicide. And we thought it would be the perfect person to come and talk to and to really understand how we can get over some of the challenges that men have when it comes to talking about their mental well-being. So without further ado, let's get into this episode. Welcome to the Never Not Creative podcast. My name's Andy Wright, and we are kicking off a little mini series with into men's mental health in our industry, probably men's mental health overall. But given that we're all about the creative industry, that's what we're going to be focusing on. And I'm delighted to welcome probably one of the best experts I've ever spoken to around men's mental health, who is Zach Seidler, who is a psychologist from Movember and also an expert and very passionate advocate around improving the suicide rates around men's mental health. Welcome to the podcast, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Andy. Great to be here.
You've already had your morning dip, you were telling me, which, let's just remind everyone, it's 5th of July in Sydney, which means it's pretty cold outside.
It was 8 degrees outside and 21 in the water though. So it's, I just stayed in the water. You just got to stay in there. But I can't, you can't talk about men's mental health if you don't, you know, live in the dream yourself and trying exactly to find your own rituals. So that's something very close to my heart for sure.
Yeah, excellent. So let's start with kind of like what drove you into this field in the first place.
There's quite a few pathways. And I think lots of people, when they try to describe why they got into something, create a really simplistic story. But I don't think that that's fair, especially something as complex as mental health. There's always going to be your own individual factors, and then you add in, you know, what culture is doing and all of that, and then your university days and what you learn and who you talk to. So I kind of knew from a very early age that I wanted to be a psychologist. It was mainly because I didn't want to be a doctor or a lawyer, which was very much pushed in my family. And I was like, I'm going to find the sweet spot in between these. And as a result, I guess I started to be a part of this community of mental health practitioners. And as I was learning and you know, doing my, God knows, 10 years of study, I realized that no one was talking about men and masculinity. I realized that I was the only man in my course. And what became evident was that, you know, rightfully so, masculinity was being talked about with regards to the patriarchy and privilege and everything that men have and have gained over time and the power, etc. But no one was looking at the downsides and the suffering and the trauma that many men go through. And it meant that lots of guys were being disregarded when it came to their pain and suffering. I then, you know, had my own battles with anxiety. My family's had some issues. My friends, you know, watching, I think, growing up in it, I'm very lucky, especially now reflecting on what's going on in schools today, that I went to a co-ed school and I had a lot of interaction with girls and doing drama and music and just being able to understand that they could relate to one another in such different ways. And I wanted a piece of that. And so when I went and played footy with the guys, I was like, why do I restrict my conversation here? Why am I falling back onto misogynistic shit that I don't believe in when I'm, you know, chatting with them? And so just watching the difference between them and finding my own comfort space there meant that I, you know, practiced that emotional conversation and communication. And I also realized the benefits in doing it. And I saw what I could derive from it in my relationships. So that definitely pushed me further. And then once you start looking into this space, you can't really stop. And so I did my honors looking at male cancer survivors and how they come back from treatment and talk about sex with their partners, which was a really rogue thing to do, but I loved it, talking to 70-year-old men about sex. And then after that, it really moved into looking at depression and looking at, you know, how does this stuff look and manifest in men, and why is it going undiagnosed and untreated, and why is the suicide rate so high? And I just wanted to talk to guys and understand what's going on, and that's what's led me here today.
So obviously, you know, depression and anxiety, like we've found, are pretty rife within our industry, but it's not as easy as saying there's just kind of depression and anxiety. Like obviously there are different things that lead to them. What have you noticed about the differences between men and women?
Yeah, well, there's so much difference between men and men, and this is the thing that so many people, you know, fail to look at, because the gender difference is always so interesting to everyone. Everyone loves a binary for some reason, because it gives you this equal comparison. But we know that men and women, you know, are so different when it comes to their mental health. And then, as I said, you look within men and you end up with just as much diversity. So the reason really that I got into this is because the way that men express their depression often slips through the cracks. And you end up with guys showing what are considered sanctioned, socially sanctioned behaviors like anger, aggression, irritability, frustration. You get lots of somatic symptoms like headaches and sleep problems. You know, the amount of guys that have come into me and to GPs and go, oh, I've just got these recurring headaches and I'm, you know, I feel really like my joints are hurting, and they describe all these physical symptoms because, God forbid, you know, they start to talk about what's underlying that. And a well-trained physician should make those links, but typically they don't, sadly. And so we get a lot of guys coming in or not coming in who are just experiencing this type of overwhelming angst, anger. You know, there's links between violence and suicidality as well. You know, domestic violence is often, in my eyes, just a flip coin with suicidality. It's just pain and suffering that is misunderstood and is being either put on yourself or put on somebody else. And hopefully we can get to the point where we can intervene earlier to avoid that type of crisis, because we know that guys show up much later than they should often to seek help. But when it comes down to it, that internalizing feeling, which is like hopelessness and worthlessness, that type of stuff that women, you know, often describe when they're talking about depression or anxiety, is experienced by guys, but it seems that it starts out like that with a kernel and then just gets repressed and pushed down, because that's not okay. We can't describe stuff like that. And what that does is it means that, you know, naturally the bucket is going to overflow. So rather than allowing that a voice and allowing that to be treated, what happens is it gets pushed down and over time it expands, and then you get those blow-ups, which is often what happens, and you see it in the corporate space all the time. And then you get substance misuse trying to dull everything, and that's huge within the creative industries as well. So it's just understanding, and this comes down to a literacy perspective, like, do people actually know what those initial internal feelings are and how to respond to them without shame and guilt and you know, frustration? Because that's what's going on with guys. They're experiencing the same thing as women at the start, as we all do. We're all human. It's just the way that they choose to respond to it that differs.
And so does this come back to, I guess a lot of it comes back to our views of masculinity and what, who we're supposed to be as men, and, you know, stiff upper lip and not showing weakness. And is that what it still keeps coming back to?
So, you know, everyone loves the nature versus nurture situation. I wouldn't be a good psychologist if I was a, you know, a nature side of the argument, because I believe so strongly that I can hopefully make change in what is their environment and the way that they're brought up. And so the way that masculinity is socialized means that, as you know, you can look at four-year-old kids, and there's been incredible studies where you go into childcare and you follow these kids from 4 to 6. And at 4, boys have a much wider emotional spectrum, actually, mm-hmm. than girls do, you know, and I'm sure you've witnessed it probably, where there's endless tantrums, there's all of this, there's crying, there's sadness, there's happiness, there's joy. But over time, it slowly starts to, you know, constrict. And the reasons are, and they watch the way that the boys interact with one another. They watch the way that the boys interact with their parents when they come in. And the responses that they get for emotionality are, you know, really just rejecting them in many instances. Whereas, you know, girls are given time to grieve and worry, and all of this stuff is kind of allowed to an extent. Not to say that it's easy to be a woman with emotions these days either, but there seems to be an understanding as a young person especially that it's condoned to go and do some of these things. And so what happens is that as these boys age, you watch at 4 and they've got more than girls at 5, it starts to get equal, and at 6 you end up losing, you know, so much of this emotional expression. But what you lose is not only the sadness and the tantrums on this end, but you actually lose joy and happiness on the other end as well. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with, you know, guys having such a muted sense of emotion and ability to express themselves, which is really sad to see, because you want both ends of the spectrum. And so I don't think that it is anything that is, you know, not able to be spoken about and undone, I guess, in many instances. It just needs to be focused on and talked about earlier. And parents need to consider this stuff, and teachers need to consider this stuff. And then in the workplace as well, it's like, what type of role models, male role models, do we have going around? Because it needs to come in a multi-pronged approach. You can have the best parents in the world, and you go into school and you get bullied to shit every day. It's not going to help. The peer pressure weighs on you much more than, you know, good parenting. So I think that we need to consider how masculinity obviously has some constraints. It's very difficult for many men to grow up in this space. It's, as we've said, it's traumatic, it's shame inducing, it's really difficult for them. But there's also the flip side, which is that it brings with it great strength and ability and enjoyment, and, you know, the banter and the friendship and the mateship that, you know, kind of goes glossed over as well. So we're focusing a lot on what's bad and not enough on what's good. And what that means is that men are starting to even further distance themselves from these conversations, because they feel like something can go wrong in what they say, you know, they can be cancelled. All of this stuff happens, and it means that we're having a breakdown in communication, which we need to move past, I think.
It's true, isn't it? Like that part around watching what you say and feeling like you could get shot down at any moment is probably almost, whilst we've all become more aware of the issues around masculinity, it's almost kind of put more pressure on saying the right thing at the moment.
For sure.
Yeah.
I don't know why masculinity, you know, has become a women's issue. You know, I only speak to women about it, and it's gender seems to be only of interest to them. This reflective, introspective ability amongst men is not something that is respected, is not something that is sought after. And it's harming us, because we're not doing the hard yards. We're not having those conversations. And so I don't necessarily want men to go about and have un-PC conversations where they're just, you know, ripping on everyone. But I do want them to go and have frank, you know, conversations where there's no shame in sitting around amongst a group of men and talking about violence, for instance, and talking about your own mental health. And it's not a matter of, oh, this is stigmatized or whatever. It's like, how can we have a raw conversation in a way that makes sense for us? Everyone keeps talking about we need to have mental health conversations. Men need to talk more. It doesn't need to be this stereotypical bullshit. It needs to happen in a way, in a place that makes sense to you. You know, there has to be an understanding that these environments, that the dialogue, you know, you can include, and this is something that my members tried to do a lot of and has largely succeeded, including humor and banter and male ways of communicating and describing things into their interventions. It doesn't need to be, you know, all darkness all the time. This is humanity, and men need to realize that this is, you know, a part of everyone's life. And so it doesn't need to be this secret thing that exists in the distance.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously, like, the reason we started tackling mental health in our industry was because we recognized there was lots of good information out there, and it's almost like the textbooks are out there, but it needs translating into, you know, for I think for us in the creative industry, we found that it's like, geez, everything gets a bit dry and serious when you start talking about mental health. And then you add, you know, blokes into the mix as well. And it really feels like it's this, whatever you're about to do or talk about in mental health is going to end up like a bit of a chore.
Mm.
And is that, I guess, Movember plays a fairly big role in trying to improve the tonality of the conversation. Do we have to go further than where we're currently at? Like, it feels like we just still haven't hit the sweet spot, have we, in terms of being able to talk to men about their mental health?
For sure. And I think it's been so monotonous. You know, Movember is kind of, we're kind of aloof in the mental health sector because we just do what we want and we do it in a very different way. But we're not an intervention, you know, based, we're not there to provide crisis support or anything like that. Mm-hmm. We're there to provide a bit of education, really, and insight into what's going on in the world of men. But the way that everyone is talking about mental health is so doom and gloom. And we know that the vast majority, and I'm lucky in my day-to-day clinical life, that I work with people who, you know, survive and thrive with mental health issues. Mm. So we need to get to the point where we can discuss this stuff and how it, for instance, exists within the workplace and how it can be to use to your advantage. You know, there are certain elements of anxiety that are superpowers. It's just when it tips over that it becomes problematic. And there are many people you'll talk to, even with the most severe, you know, form of mental illness like schizophrenia, which never gets, you know, its time in the light, who will still say that they would never wish that they didn't have it, you know, or people with autism who would say, mm-hmm. because it's your personality, it's everything about you. And we need to get to the point where people don't want to excuse, you know, the difficulties that they have, but rather find that silver lining and find a way to, you know, include it in their everyday. Because depression, for instance, means that you feel. It means that you feel, you know, the depths of other people's pain. You can feel how your own actions are having ramifications on others. There's just a line when it becomes unhealthy for you and unhelpful, most importantly. And it's just a matter of understanding where that is. There's no reason for this to be something that is demonized and is something that we really need to avoid, like the plague. We're going through one right now. But I think that we need to understand that it is such a feature of our everyday existence. And without it in the workplace, even though it's gone completely clandestine, really, for the past 50 years, we wouldn't be where we're at.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's when we talk about mental health in our industry, whilst we recognize that, you know, half the industry is showing signs of anxiety and depression, but on the flip side, like, look at it as, like, look at the amazing work that, you know, creatives can do despite some of the things that they're experiencing. One of the things that we found in the research was almost like the top level of stresses for people. And so some of the top ones were the pressure that people put on themselves, multiple responsibilities, pressure from others, and unrealistic expectations that get set on them at work. Do they resonate with things that you've found? Are there any there that specifically stick out for men versus women?
Mm. They're things that I experience personally every day. But I think that this idea, and I think we've spoken about this before, that this is a rite of passage, you know, and that if you come into the creative industry, expect this. You know, and I went through it, so you're going to go through it, and this is just how it's going to be. You know, again, there's real use in having high expectations. There's real use in being very clear on what you want to achieve out of something and pushing others to an extent to get the most out of them. It's when it becomes, you know, deeply problematic and pathological, I guess, in many instances, that we need to pay attention to. But when it comes to guys and what I've experienced and researched, that notion of having such a high bar is really something that we work with every day just because of the way that manhood is, you know, drilled into us, is that here is this unattainable standard. Yeah. Here is this idea that you need to be stoic and self-reliant and strong and powerful, but also, because now we're in the 21st century, you've got to be vulnerable. And you've got to know when to cry, and you've got to be a good dad, and you've got to do this and that. And so conflicting messages, and you are never going to get that right, that balance. It's never going to happen. So that's kind of the undercurrent. That's the subtext of our everyday existence. And as a result, having that running through us, this constant comparison as well with other men in our lives, and where do we, you know, end up on the spectrum, I guess, of manhood, means that you deal with constant daily personal failures. Mm-hmm. So what you do, I guess, in many instances, is just try to make up for that. And you make up for that by power grabbing, I guess. And in the research, that's called gender role conflict, which is your gender role, which is your masculinity and your idea of what you should be, is in conflict because you can't attain it. It's just not going to happen. And as a result, you backlash with the very behaviors, you know, that are detrimental to you. So, for instance, it's like you've been attacked for your manhood one way or another, and as a result, you go and you demonize somebody else and you bring them down to your level as a result, or you go off and you drink excessively to try to numb the pain, which makes you more of an asshole in the long term as well. So you end up in this cycle, which can very easily be broken down when it's spoken about and seen. But it's often that there are these internalized ruptures that happen in the workplace where somebody gets put down, where somebody gets rejected, where something is not good enough. And these guys don't necessarily know how to handle that. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the, you know, repercussions, the behaviors that follow are really not in their best interests.
Mm. There's quite often I hear it quite a bit. I've probably been a part of it, like quite anecdotal references to a boys' club in our industry. And certainly, like, you've only got to look, like in many other workplaces, the top of the ladder is going to be overwhelmingly male. I think it is improving a little bit, but probably not as quickly enough. So while there are like obvious issues for those not in the club, what impact do you think it does have on those in the club? Like, they probably are conflicted, right, in terms of what they should be thinking and should be doing. But then I think this kind of talks a bit to what you were just saying, how like you've kind of got to protect your status and your power, and like you're worried about, like, basically the only way it would feel to them is down rather than up.
And that's kind of what I guess feminism is trying to sell to men, which is that you're not going to lose anything.
Yeah, we're not a threat.
It'll be all right. You'll be fine. And it's a branding issue, really, you know. The boys' club, I would love the boys' club to be rebranded as the place where, you know, men go to feel heard, to feel understood, to express themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's not at the cost, you know, to their own well-being and to those of, you know, others around them. I don't see that happening for the next little while, but, you know, we're trying slowly but surely. And I like to think, having just been, you know, in the city a few weeks ago and seen a group of 16-year-old schoolboys on the train talking about anxiety and trauma just by accident, I was like, I just stumble upon it. And I'm like, things are changing.
Yeah.
Yes, young boys still have all of the same bloody issues that we do, but they're starting to gain the communication and the you know, the ability to describe what's happening to them. But why don't the guys in the boys' clubs, you know, step out of the room, is because of the uncertainty and the what is uncontrollable about the outside world. When you're a part of the club, the ostracism and the fear of not being in it, and it follows us from high school. That's the exact same thing. We conducted some research with lots of young guys, less affluent guys across Australia. And, you know, one of the most resounding quotes that came back to me was, I'd rather have shit friends than no friends.
Wow.
You know, that idea of being alone and being ostracized is such a painful reality for many of these guys. What is conferred upon them by being in the boys group is not only this idea of power and privilege, but a sense of belonging. And that's what keeps people alive, to be honest. You know, we know that footy clubs and that community legitimately can keep people alive. But it would be really great if these same communities, if this same sense of belonging can bring with it positive, healthy behaviors as a result. It just so happens that that sense of belonging is built on, you know, bringing down others, which is in no one's interest.
So there's this campaign out at the moment, isn't there, about speaking up when you see things that are not kind of, you know, I guess, politically politically is wrong, isn't it? That sounds naff, but correct in terms of, you know, I think there's one ad where there's one guy training another guy in the morning and they see, you know, what is shown to be a good looking woman running across, and he goes, oh, this is worth getting up at 6 a.m. for. And we all sort of know what he should have said, or, you know, and that the person it was directed to should be able to talk back. But if you're in that group, and one of your biggest reasons for being in that group is a sense of belonging, and therefore one of the biggest risks of speaking up is a sense of rejection, how do you bring this up to your group? You know, and we've got this in footy clubs, we've got it in workplaces. How do you be the person that says this without being ostracized and, you know, removed pretty quickly from the club?
So something that's really important within the research, and I'm sure many of your listeners will understand, is something called the perception gap, which is this idea of the way that we believe in masculine stereotypes as individuals. So say, I believe, you know, that men should be the breadwinner. I believe that, you know, men should be, as we said, self-reliant and stoic, that all of these stereotypes that exist. The way that individual men believe in these things in comparison to the way that they think society believes in them is a huge gap. So we looked at, again, you know, 3,000 young Australians, and we see that there's around 20 to 30% of them who really strongly agree with these ideas, which is problematic, there's no doubt. But when you ask those same guys what they believe society thinks, it bumps up to 50.
Yeah.
So, and everyone is going through this, you know, every guy is going, no, I think out there, they're going to judge me. But actually every individual guy is going, I don't actually believe in this shit. You know, I just have this pressure because of this perception gap. The perception gap is saying society is telling you this, even though society might not be telling them this. It's just this weight on their shoulders that they feel. And so what that means is that we end up in this space where guys go, I can't act out because everybody will see and everybody is against me if I go about that. And again, I'll be ostracized accordingly. But the best way for a campaign to shift this behavior is to get lots of guys finding, I guess it should be the strong link, but it is the weak link in their group, because knowing that everyone is feeling this stuff, every young guy that I speak to wants to have honest, vulnerable conversations with their mates. They just feel like, you know, it's going to end badly. They don't know what to say, etc. But there are at least three of them in the group of five who want to be doing this.
Yeah.
So how can we find those, you know, those means for connection to start? Because that's all it takes. It just takes two people. It just takes understanding that you're not a sole unit in this dialogue. And as I always talk about when it comes to like consent and sexual abuse and everything, especially within schools, we've spoken about role models, but I think it really needs to come from the within group. You know, it can't come from the externals, just like in the workplace. It can't come from, you know, the executives who just throw stuff down and then don't actually live it. You know, that's even worse. So we need someone within your group who has some power, you know, the cool kid in the schoolyard, to come forward and go, oh, actually, I asked her if she wanted to sleep with me and she said, nah, not just yet. And I said, okay, cool, I'll wait. But I'm going to get to have sex with her and it's going to be great and we're going to wait, you know. And it's like, how can we find the way to sell that argument as beneficial to everyone, as respectful, and still you've held on to your masculinity, you know. That's something that I really want to work towards, and finding those people within every organization, within the school, who are willing to have this chat. Because, you know, I think that people misunderstand that, you know, me coming out as a feminist or describing the way that I go about talking to men and women about this stuff, I get endless privilege as a result of that as well. You know, I get so much support from people. Yes, I get, you know, a random death letter from a middle-aged white dude who's just shitty, and that's just the way it's going to be. But largely, I get support and I get heard and I get published and all of this stuff, you know, that being a silent agreeer with a system that you don't necessarily, you know, believe in, you get nothing. That doesn't confer anything upon you. So I think we need to sell guys talking up and the benefits that come with it. You know, even if it's a 10 grand pay cut, you know, understanding how this fits in and what it's going to do for your well-being, we haven't marketed that well enough at all to guys. So why would they come on board?
Hmm. So if you're in that group, how do you, what are the signs that you're looking for in the others that you can go to and say, hey, actually, I'm pretty sure you might believe the same as me that we shouldn't be talking about this anymore. Mm. Is there a way to sort of pick up? Because again, it's that sort of first step, isn't it? Of like, oh, what if I pick the wrong one and he smacks me down and he turns everyone against me?
I think the kit, yeah, well, that's the threat. I guess what I always try to say is if they're going to do that, then fuck them, to be honest, yeah. You know? And that's hard to say because, you know, well, it's easy to say in my position, but it's hard for them to take. But I think that what happens is that there is a level of respect when it comes to standing up for what you believe in amongst men. And finding the way to communicate that is really the key. And what I always say, and I say this to women and to violence organizations and everyone, is that we need to try to reduce the shame-inducing dialogue, because that's what gets guys way off, you know? If they feel like they've been shamed, because there's already so much shame, you know, misogyny and all of this shit that guys are saying very often doesn't come from a place of happiness. They're doing it because they're attempting to hold on to something for dear life. And so if you further trigger that by putting them down rather than trying to not educate, we're not trying to educate necessarily, but rather just try to show them a different angle, you know, we can do it in ways that aren't going to distance them, that aren't going to put them off, but reinforce, look, we can talk about this in another way. And so what I try to do when I'm in a group with various people, you can sense in the body language, you know, who's on board. Mm-hmm. And guys don't do one-on-ones well enough, I don't think, at the moment. So, you know, taking a guy aside and just being like, what do you think about this? Or I want to have a campaign in the office for Movember this year, you know. Mm. There are always ways to trigger a meaningful conversation. And I always say that role modeling means sharing your own story, and you can do it in a way that makes sense again for the way that you relate to your mates. It doesn't need to be that really dark doom and gloom conversation. It can just be, this is what's been going on for me, chuck in a bit of banter, a bit of joking around, back to it. That the problem at the moment is that the banter comes in and you never come back to it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yes, it's almost like someone took that escape route out pretty quickly. Oh, thank you, out we go. Yeah.
We need peaks and troughs, but you need to come back and realize that discomfort will pass, and every time we do it, it gets easier and easier.
Yeah. So it does. It feels, doesn't it? Like I think this is the thing with mental health. It's the thing with masculinity around, like, generationally, there's definitely something changing, right? Like, you know, kids are having different conversations. There's probably even, you know, I think about conversations that I would have had or not had, you know, with my parents versus, you know, the conversations I try and have with my kids, which isn't a reflection about parenting. It's a reflection of the times. Mm. But what do we do for the people stuck in the middle? Because there are people who are, you know, literally suffering right now. There's the weight of expectation. There's the, you know, even your analogy there was quite interesting, because it's like, there was a group I used to play football with, and I sort of removed myself from that group. And now I play with another group, and like, it's great. And I kind of like, it's actually all much more respectful. It does feel like pretty good, but there's obviously always that kind of, you know, there's a comment now and again or something like that. But at the same time, I realize and recognize what it's doing for my mental health, because I'm a part of something, I'm exercising. And then you don't want to kind of ruin what that's doing for you.
Mm.
This is my therapy session now.
We're on the clock. I think that's really fair. And that's always, you know, I would never suggest to someone to just blow up these relationships or just, you know, leave, you know, a football group with guys you've known for however long. It's just a matter of trying to understand, where are those pressure points? You know, what can you and can you not touch? And just, it's for your own values. That's what it comes down to. People are like, oh, let's talk about the impact that this is having on you within these environments. You know, it's like, oh, I can put up with this. It's like, really? Because if I'm going every week and playing football with these guys and I'm feeling ostracized, even though I'm part of the in-group, I'm still like, oh, I don't actually agree with anything any of these guys are saying. I feel a bit off every time I come home, but I still feel this pull to keep going back. Mm-hmm. That's where the question needs to come in. And that's where it goes, all right, I can tell them that I love them. I can tell them that I want to be there, but I can tell them that this stuff is just a bit uncomfortable for me. And why? You know, it's for me personally. And it doesn't need to be an attack. It can just be like, you know, I've been thinking about this stuff a lot recently and understanding where it sits for you and you being that role model again. It means you have to put yourself out on the line, which is very difficult. But it's also understanding when you're going to let something go through the keeper. And you need to understand your own energy levels there, because I've fought too many battles that are that were worthless to start with, and understanding that it's just not necessary. And it is actually really irritating sometimes to do that when there was no harmful intent, you know, and I pick up on a word here or there that's just like, we don't need to do this. And so it's trying to understand again where that safe middle ground is for you and picking and choosing your times so that they're powerful. I think that that's something that's really important.
And like you said before, like, this is also the perception gap part, which is actually you might just find there's more than half of the group thinking the same way.
It's just everyone's crapping on. We just all grew up in this environment where it's like, oh, it's my turn to say something about that bitch over there now. So yeah, you know, it's like, how did this come out? I don't agree with that. But we bring it out of one another, but we all hate ourselves for it. So it's like, why did we get caught in this trap and how can somebody break it? And it, you know, it does just take, and sometimes I've been on WhatsApp groups and I call it out and I get kicked out of the group, and that happens. And what's really important to understand, and we've done some research, is looking at when it comes to behavior change, whether it be mental health or otherwise, there's the 20% who are locked in their ways and they're not going to move. There's the 20% who are doing everything, you know, it's 30% at the top who do everything really well and they look after themselves. And then there's that 40% of persuadables, as we call them. And this is, you know, who we need to market to. This is where the creative industries need to ramp up the messaging, because it's those guys in the middle who will come on board if we talk to them accordingly. But you need to understand your market. You need to understand who you're talking to. If the vast majority of your friends are in those no-go zone guys who are never going to change and have been endlessly conservative and, you know, misogynistic and harmful in their ways for however long, don't waste your energy, I don't think.
That just made me think. So I've had, obviously we've done a thing called Never Not International Women's Day recently, and it's given women, you know, trans, women of color, non-binary, the opportunity to kind of talk about some of the challenges that they face in the workplace and they face in society, but also in terms of like their ability to get on with their career as well. And we've had a few, you know, supportive men during that process as well. But there's this, I can't help but feel that some of the thing to get over is that men are potentially, you know, like you touched on this, am I about to give up the power that I have? Whereas actually I've heard so many stories that men have been given their best opportunities by women. Right. And so like, we shouldn't be afraid of them being in these positions. Actually, it's better for everyone. You're going to get, if anything, more appreciated. And there's probably a sense of more kind of wholesome achievement, perhaps, than just riding a wave that, you know, other men have set up for you.
Yeah.
Is there any sort of research that supports that? And also, are there any industries, you know, whether or examples at work, I guess, that you've seen that are making inroads into this challenge?
Yeah. I think I would love to see a whole, you know, we always talk about International Men's Day and it's very problematic for many reasons, but I would just love to see, you know, a seminar with 10 guys who are top level in the creative industries, or the legal profession, whatever it is, talking about what being a man has done, positive and negative, because you need to have both. Because if we just talk about it as negative, every woman will be like, yeah, but you wouldn't be there. So it's very fair to call on that. But to discuss, that would just never happen at the moment. You know, it really wouldn't. You get these types of conversations where you've got two people, but to have a really vocal chorus of, you know, high-flying guys talking about what's been difficult for them and admitting the things that they've done that they're not proud of, you know, for instance, and what they're striving for and hoping for, I would love to see that. That aside, when it comes to, you know, men understanding the benefits of working with women, I think everyone is going to do this thing. It's like when people were Islamophobic back in the day and they'd go, no, but I know a Muslim, you know. It's like this idea that you can get out of it. It's like, no, I work with Betty and she's the best, but yeah. I am, you know, a misogynistic dickhead. That's not good enough for me. But I think the way that guys interact with women in the workplace is shifting. Women are taking back, rightfully so, you know, the voice, really, and are, you know, stamping their mark on the workforce and how it's going to look moving forward. We need to embrace that and understand the broad skill set and performance and, you know, leadership abilities and skills that women bring, and try to find a way to leverage those to everyone's advantage. Because without that, it's just like holding on to the past. It's just unnecessary and it's not useful. And we know that as fathers coming up, you know, having more equal, you know, paternity leave as well is what feminism is fighting for. You know, trying to get men to be able to take time with their kids and have that space during that such, you know, important period of their lives to understand that they can take a break. You know, we need to find that middle ground where everyone can kind of balance all of this stuff accordingly. And that means leaning on women when it's right and leaning on men, you know, in other instances. But we're not, again, this Venus and Mars situation is so problematic because there are really assertive women, there are really shy women. It's the same thing amongst men. And it's just so problematic that these leadership styles have been grouped under genders because that means that when a woman is considered assertive, it's like, oh, look at these masculine traits in her. And that's really, you know, it's reductionist because she's, I'm sure, just like a guy who's a leader, has many shades that just get lost in the wash.
I reckon we can make that event happen.
Cool.
Like, that's a great, we've been, I've also become a member of this committee called Fuck the Cupcakes, which Jasmine Badir runs. She's a CEO at Inotion Advertising Agency. And we've been doing some work into this space of, like, you know, yes, you can continue to kind of push the agenda for women, but actually it's women listening to women. And, you know, so that's where her kind of frustration came around and the idea of Fuck the Cupcakes. But we've been talking about how do we improve, I guess, giving license to men to come along this journey. And, you know, one of those ideas is like, oh, you know, here's the creativity and football session. But actually maybe, you know, you're right. Like, rather than just two or three people conversations or panels, like, let's get a much bigger group that is more influential. And probably then as well just shows people that it's a better representation of, you know, the reality of the perception gap, right? Yeah, like, yeah. I kind of feel like that's a really important thing that you've mentioned there as part of this. So,
and there's nothing wrong with going by the creativity and football situation and tricking dudes in, and then, but that's the thing. It's like, you're bringing them in and you should talk about creativity in football. And the fact that mental health is interlinked in everything is just the reality of the case. So, you know, we've done that endlessly at Movember and otherwise, you know, all of these organizations have done like, oh, come and bring in your car and we'll fix up your car and then we'll fix up your mind. You know, it's always like that. So I'd like to think we'll get to a place where guys don't need that cell at the front that's going to attempt to fool them. But in saying that, we run men's groups, you know, with disadvantaged young people, and we give them dinner, and that's enough to get them talking. You know, it's like, where can we understand? And this means talking to guys. That's what it comes down to. It's like, rather than being like, how can we trick them? It's like, no, why don't you ask them what they want?
Yeah.
But actually ask them in a meaningful way, not just like, if we were to talk about mental health. It's like, don't make that an initial assumption already. Rather trying to get to the core of what's stopping you and what are those blocks and what can we do differently. And I think, again, that peer pressure situation comes in, and putting aside time in lieu of performance, all of those things, we need to get to the point where productivity and efficiency and performance are seen as key indicators that are directly reliant upon your well-being, and no one is there yet.
We have this slide that we present in the mental health presentations that it asks people, what would they like to see happen at work that would improve their mental well-being? And none of the top five, and these top five are out like by a country mile in terms of the things that people really want, mention the words mental health. They're all about leaders leading by example. They're about, you know, walking the walk and talking the talk. Mm. They're about having clarification around what they're supposed to deliver, having flexible working conditions, all of these types of things, and just a more empathetic culture. And it, you know, really opens your eyes to actually you don't even have to talk about mental health, you know, in some of these cases. If you're not ready for that yet, that's okay. And, you know, in the first wave of research we did, like, we found such big correlations between job satisfaction and levels of mental health that, again, like, if you're worried about talking to your boss about mental health, then why don't you just go and talk to your boss about whether you're satisfied in your job or work or not? Because that's a perfectly legitimate conversation to have without anyone, you know, depending on their level of understanding, without anyone feeling like they will judge you.
We need to understand what the fact that mental health really does, you know, cover that whole spectrum. It's not around, oh, I need to, and this is the problem with organizations. They go, we have an EAP. And we offer a well-being fucking thing every once in a while.
Well, those are all the things on the bottom of that list. It's basically the mental health check.
Yeah, no one cares. It's like, what is my day-to-day? I don't want to do this well-being, you know, retreat once a year, because we know you can go away on a holiday and come back 2 weeks later and feel like garbage. It doesn't do anything. It's your day-to-day processes and managerial style and understanding, you know, roles and responsibilities, all of that type of stuff, and the pressure that exists. You know, I put pressure on the people that I work with, there's no doubt about it, but it comes from a means of, you know, an understanding of respect and understanding as well of their own limits. And I always make clear, it's like, if you can't reach it, we just need open and honest communication. That's what it comes down to, and fear will never allow for that. And that's what's happening endlessly. Everybody in the corporate structures are so afraid of one thing or another, and everyone is afraid. And therefore, when you get into a managerial role, you think that creating fear in the people beneath you, again, is a rite of passage, is something you need to live up to. And we need to break that cycle.
Yeah. All right. I think we've hit our limit for time. I really appreciate it. This has been an amazing chat. Maybe we'll follow it up. But I'll tell you one thing we will do. I will make that event happen. It'd be awesome if you'd be in the mix for the chat. Maybe you moderate it or something. I think it would be great.
I'd love to.
And so, yeah, we'll make that happen, because I think that could make a big thing. And you know what? It hasn't been done before, so we don't know. So it's worth a crack.
For sure. Awesome. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you very much, Zach. It's been great to have you, and great to chat as always.
Cheers.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed what Zach had to say. He is such an amazing resource to be able to invite onto the podcast, and is fast becoming a big friend of Never Not Creative. If you haven't already, I think we're probably getting very close to closing the survey on empathy. So please head over to nevernotcreative.org/empathy and fill out the survey to help us understand your understanding of empathy and how we can use it to help create better mental wellness in our industry. Also remember that asking for a friend is always online. You can find past episodes. You can find past episodes with Zach even as well. Just head to nevernotcreative.org and search for asking for a friend. And finally, thanks to Streamtime for all the support, for all the time and equipment that they lend to us to be able to do this podcast, and also a lot of the initiatives that we do for Never Not Creative. Just head over to streamtime.net to be able to sign up, give it a go, and who knows, you'll end up speaking to me maybe, but definitely one of our amazing team. That's it for now. See you on the next episode. Thanks for listening.